Australia, what's your favorite sport?
Football.
Snack?
Pies.
Animal?
Kangaroo.
And what's your favorite car, Australia?
Holden.
Let me see, that's football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, huh?
Right.
I'm Jonathan Green, this is Blueprint for Living and it's grand final day in Sydney and Melbourne. The footballs that stopped the nation, and in honour of that special national day, our last half hour theme. Football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars. Grand final day at the MCG today. 24,000 pies and sausage rolls or thereabouts will be served. Do you realise there is a particular Australian pie maker that churns out 50,000 pies every hour of every day? The average Australian eats 12 meat pies per year. We are going to taste some. It's our duty as public broadcasters to guarantee the efficacy of this national snack. The dynamic duo from Life Matters, Amanda Smith and Michael McKenzie, have volunteered their palates to this worthy endeavour.
Volunteered? We were conscripted.
I'm sorry. You're right. All right.
I'm in denial about the football, but I will accept a free feed.
Amanda has tried to, boost her stocks after Richmond's unseemly defeat. All right. We have four pies. One of them is a 4-20, one of them is a Bowcastle, one of them is Philippa's Bakery, and one of them is the Tivoli Road Bakery. They've been cut up on your plate. You don't know which one's which. And we're going to eat them in turn. There are judging categories on overall appearance, pastry, meat, gravy, and structural integrity.
What about crumb? I've always wanted to judge
comes,
on crumb.
Michael, under structural integrity.
Right.
Each will be judged out of five, and then we will at the end reveal our winner. All right, ladies, right. Gentlemen.
Can the
start
well,
your
I
first
can't
pie.
Say, I can't say can the pies, can I? Can
no.
the eagles
Here we
or
go.
The roosters
here's,
or the storm?
Here's number one.
Number one. All right, so we're having a go.
Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. Lifting up number one.
It's not bad.
Because there's nothing better, as I discovered when I did a food show, than eating on air.
Oh, yes,
no
it's
one,
the best thing.
It's such a crowd pleaser.
Everybody enjoying their
quite
breakfast?
Stringy meat with some carrot. Let me try the pastry.
Okay, yeah, I like that.
I'm bloody hungry. This is fantastic.
That's good.
I just dropped some.
That's
excellent.
Okay.
Meat
number one.
Wow.
It's a bit steak and kidney or something,
isn't it?
That's number one. I think everyone's enjoying that.
All right, I have a sip of water. Can we cleanse the palate between...
You may.
Do you have a spittoon?
You may not spit. We'll be back with pie number two.
Football.
Now, there's one thing about today's AFL Grand Final that I can absolutely guarantee. It will be played using a Sheron football, and my guest is Sid Sheron. Now, he is a fourth-generation football maker. Sid, welcome.
Yes, welcome.
What a very proud family history.
You know, it's one of those things that not everyone gets a chance to call themselves a Sheron, and it goes back to 1879 when we first made our first football.
This was a breakthrough moment for Australian football when Tom Sheron reconfigured. I mean, he changed the game. Tell us what he did. What did he create?
Well, he was a saddler, so he'd repair all sorts of leather equipment for horses and works like that. But he was a member of Britannia Football Club, which was a rough and tumble side in the northern parts of Melbourne, which they loved their Australian rules football. And quite often the footballs would come into the saddlery because at that time they used, the balls were English rugby balls that were being used for Australian rules football. And because they were pointy, had pointed ends to them, the ends used to wear. So he had the task of repairing rugby balls, and basically that's how it all started.
One day he made his own.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he thought, well, look, let's have something that would work better for Aussie rules. And I hate to bring it up, but that poor chap in the 2010 grand final when the ball was just about to get into the goal square and the St Kilda player was just about to pick it up and kick a goal, well, it didn't. It bounced through for a point. And that's the beautiful unpredictability of Aussie rules. But what Tom did, he took the pointy ends off the ball to make it still difficult to bounce and still unpredictable, but it was a little bit easier.
It's this wonderful hybrid, isn't it? It's rounder than the rugby ball, and yet, as you say, it's still an unpredictable,
very much so,
piece of leather. So the Sheron football, that's legendary. I mean, that although Carlton fans will direct you towards the Faulkner ball.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because During the 70s, it was part of the constitution that there were two balls presented to the AFL captains. One was a Sharon football and the other one was a Faulkner football. And we're talking 12 clubs back in the 1970s.
Yep.
And 10 clubs used our ball. Fitzroy used the Faulkner football because Ross Faulkner was a life member of Fitzroy Football Club. But Barassi, he was a great man. Everyone loved and still loves Ronald Dale Barassi. But he said, no, no, choose the Faulkner ball. Anything with Sharon on it, it's Collingwood, and we hate Collingwood.
Well, because Tom Sharon, your dad, Collingwood president, 1963 to 1974.
Very much so.
A legend of the club.
Yeah, yeah, but it's, you know, I always reminisce on that, but nowadays it's a little bit of a different story.
You continue to make footballs, Sid Sharon ball.
Yeah, someone said to me, can I make him a football? Well, I got out of the business in 1985, and I said, well, I haven't got no machines, I've just got my hands. And I said, look, I'll make one, and it's a bit like grandma might be doing a crochet or a knitting, or mum might be doing a jumper for the kids.
You've got a couple of balls on the go around the
house. Well, I just started sewing the football by hand, and it's just very pleasurable for a Sharon to be doing that because I use the same techniques as Tom did back in 1879. And it takes hours and hours to do it because I make them by hand.
A wonderful family connection, though, as you say, to be going back there to 1879. And there you are doing it in precisely the same way.
It is romantic because in our garage, I've got a lot of photos of our family and it just feels quite comforting thinking that they're looking down at me, looking at doing this task, which is something, which is a time-honoured routine of the Sharon Football Factory.
There's romance in it too. What did you give your wife for an engagement present?
Well, I was thinking, what should I get my bride or my fiancée? And I thought, well, a football sounds a good idea. She worked at St Vincent's Hospital and she had the nursing quarters just around the corner in George Street. So she had her engagement football and I used to go around there for lunch because I didn't like mum's sandwiches. They were all dry and terrible and Trey's used to knock up something quite nice for me. So I went there and I said, where's the football? So I poked my head in the bedroom and there's the football next to a pillow. And I said, dear, what are you doing with the football next door to your pillow? And she said, when I go to bed at night, I like it because the ball smells like you.
I think you should take that as a compliment.
She kicks it now. It's about 40 years later after we've been married, she actually still got the same ball. But I suppose it was a hot tin roof, number 32 Wellington Street, Collingwood. The factory is still there. It didn't breathe very well. And obviously doing manual work, you pick up a lather of sweat. And with that beautiful, rich smell of leather, it tended to get into the pores of your skin. And I think she was quite right. I did smell like a football.
If anyone is entitled to smell like a football, it's Sid Sharon. He's a fourth generation football maker. And there'll be a Sharon running around on the MCG. Sid, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Meat Pie Taste Off with Amanda Smith and Michael McKenzie and me. We're up to pie number two. Shall we just hook in?
Yeah. Look, right. I'm not much of a meat eater, actually, but I'm not sure I'm a connoisseur, but I'll give it a go.
These are the first meat pies I've had in about 3 years.
I don't think I've had a meat pie since I was at school, but anyway.
Really?
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, golly.
I'm a convert.
Gosh. That's not your common or garden, that one.
Ooh.
The
meat's a bit stringy, but anyway.
All right.
They don't put the best cuts in, do they?
We're marking on overall appearance, pastry, meat, gravy, and structural integrity.
All right.
Yes.
What are you putting for meat?
What am I putting?
You're putting something out of five.
I know. I'm going to copy. That's all.
Structural integrity. Does that mean it holds together, or
it can mean whatever you want to mean?
Works in the hand. Works in the hand.
Because mine was quite floppy. Yeah. Okay. In the end, it comes down to anything that works in the hand. So
the flavour was interesting on that one. There were carrots.
It was surprising.
It was just with that. And
there
was
in the first one too.
There's a little bit of rosemary I saw floating around that. I wonder if that suggests.
It's a bit gourmet. I think there's something a bit gourmet.
Well, I wonder if it suggests a departure from beef. Just a thought. Putting that out there.
Come on, Skip.
We are halfway through our pie tasting. Two pies to go, two pies done. The taste-off continues.
Kangaroo.
Pam Whiteley is coordinator of Wildlife Health Victoria. Pam, welcome. Tell us to begin a bit about Wildlife Health Victoria.
We set this project up at the Melbourne Veterinary School 10 years ago to try and improve our understanding of the health of our Victorian mammals, birds, reptiles and frogs.
So this takes us to kangaroos.
Yes.
And takes us to phalaris grass, which has a disconcerting effect on the kangaroo.
Yeah, phalaris was introduced for grazing sheep and cattle, and it's very good, but some strains at some times of the year produce a neurotoxin that's related to serotonin, and it's been known to cause chronic phalaris staggers in sheep for long, long time. But we've recently, well, in the last 10 years, we've diagnosed it in kangaroos, and colleagues have diagnosed it in the 80s and 90s and 2000s also.
Phalaris staggers, now, that I suspect is something that sheep farmers would look for and would have an awareness of.
That's right.
Well, when we see kangaroos with the staggers, that gives rise to the sort of the tabloidism of drunk kangaroos.
Yeah, well, I guess it could be any sick kangaroo. So when we go out and have a look, you can get abnormally close to them and they have tremors. And that could be, once again, any sick kangaroo.
Mm.
But they'll, when they hop off, they've got a very incoordinated, ataxic type of movement. And sometimes they'll fall over. And if they're very badly affected, I'm sure they can't get up and graze.
Is this a particular time of year for the phalaris, that it contains this neurotoxin?
Well, it's not really clearly defined, but it is often after dry periods when there's rain, so it can be early autumn.
And the kangaroos quite like it?
Yeah, it's a good feed, and sheep and cattle like it. But it has some strains, some conditions cause this problem.
So the remedy for sheep in those instances, is that something which can be transferred to kangaroos, or is it just a matter of keeping off that particular grass?
It's good if you can keep off it. There's no real remedy for sheep. If they're mildly affected, they can manage. If they're badly affected, they may need to be killed for animal welfare reasons. And there is a way of preventing it in sheep with an oral dose of cobalt. But that's not something you could do in individual kangaroos because it would be extremely stressful. And this is a population problem with the kangaroos, not just individuals.
And a herbivore that can't graze.
Well, they need to move around and graze, but that's right.
That's a herbivore in deep trouble.
Yes, yeah. And it's a consequence of European settlement and agriculture, you know, bringing in these pastures.
Any other pastures have a poor effect on the kangaroo?
There have been other reports of toxicity, and it can be, and I'm not an expert in this, it can be from the plants, but sometimes you can get toxicities from fungi that grow on the plants.
So the drunk kangaroo problem, the phalaris staggers in kangaroos, I mean, where are we seeing that geographically? Is that in specific areas?
Well, it was reported on Kangaroo Island and at Pakapunyal, and we've diagnosed it quite a few places around Victoria. But the trick is, really the important thing is to make a diagnosis, because it could be clinical signs that are due to toxoplasmosis from feral cats, or kangaroo blindness virus, or a herpes virus, or sick, weak kangaroos from various parasites. So it's very important in a location to get a diagnosis so we know what we're talking about.
Life sounds a bit tough for the kangaroo.
I guess kangaroos are doing reasonably well. They suffer in droughts and I think in general eastern grey kangaroos are doing quite well, but we've got a lot of other huge numbers of other wildlife species that are really in trouble.
And I guess at this time too, when you say suffer in drought, and drought is a phenomenon up most of the eastern seaboard of the country, and that then brings kangaroos into direct competition with grazing animals, with grazing livestock. So there's a tension there.
Yeah, I mean, kangaroos will lose joeys and reduce reproduction in poor conditions, and certainly they'll die if there's no water and it's very hot.
Mm. Well, when we see headlines about drunk kangaroos, we ought not laugh. We ought to see this is a serious problem.
Yeah, it's a problem we need to diagnose, and certainly managing wildlife problems is really a tricky business. We're not very experienced at that in Australia.
Pam, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Jonathan.
Pam Whiteley, coordinator of Wildlife Health Victoria. The Great Pie Taste, Amanda Smith, Michael McKenzie, and me. Four pies, two pies down. We're up to pie number three, which
getting,
we will now judge.
A bit full, actually.
It's pie trois.
Overall appearance, pastry, meat, gravy, structural integrity. Here we go. Pie number three.
Okay, this looks like a more traditional.
It looks very trad.
Yeah.
Although there's not as much liquid as I would expect in a trad pie. You know what I mean? How you used to
dripping with gravy.
And you'd take the roof off and then you'd suck out the inside.
That's good
burn
pastry.
Burn your mouth, burn burn the roof of your mouth, burn your tongue.
I like the crunch of that pastry.
Happy days. Tastes like a fed income.
The meat is granular.
That's something I'd expect to eat at a Collingwood football club meet.
And therefore, you know, indecipherable in a way. Don't mind that.
Nice pastry.
Don't mind that at all.
Right.
Okay. Writing down. Writing down.
Writing down our tasting notes here. That's three pies down. We only have one to go. And then the big reveal. Golden pies. Steve Normoyle is contributing editor of the Australian Muscle Car magazine. Steve is, I think, Holden, and the Holden Monaro springs to mind. Take us back to 1968.
Well, it was 50 years ago today, this year, so it's half a century. It's a fair while ago, and things were quite different. I guess for Holden at the time, it was a step in that previously they'd produced sort of fairly utilitarian vehicles, very basic cars, but the Monaro was sort of a step into the unknown, a step into something much more exciting and I guess a reflection of the emerging youth market. There was lots of younger people with a lot of disposable income. Women were working, get into the workforce in ways that they weren't before. And I mean, obviously, through the 60s, we had all sorts of social revolution and cultural revolution. So it was sort of a marketing expression of all of that excitement and trying to tap into it. So it was, very, very different, very exciting for what had been a fairly plain, stodgy, old, dependable brand.
And Holden's first venture into that muscle car territory, Holden's first V8.
Yeah, exactly. It was that too. And that sort of coalesced around the Bathurst car race, which was a phenomenon itself, developing at the time on a racing circuit that's probably one of the best in the world and sort of visually kind of encapsulates Australiana in a way, because it's not so much in the bush, but it's a rural setting and it's quite obviously Australia, and it was an enormous challenge in terms of being hard on the cars and difficult for the drivers. So
how breathtaking was the Monaro when it came out? How much did that just really go, put people back on their heels?
Well, it would have. I guess with a lot of these things, they're much more exciting in retrospect. But certainly, it would have been something fairly momentous, because I guess in simple terms, for you know, young emerging consumers with money, you could always buy a sports car type of a car if you had the money, but we're talking sort of, you know, very expensive things. But this was suddenly an exciting sports car type of vehicle that the masses could afford, and it had sort of, you know, dependable name Holden behind it. There was also a sort of sense of national pride around the brand, which was kind of ill-founded, because it was Holden had been owned by General Motors, an American company, for probably 50 years. So, look, it was all of those things. And it offered style and performance that we'd not seen before. And Holden went to big lengths to try and market it in a way that they hadn't before. We had fashion designers designing special outfits for the model that they used for one of the promotional shoots, which has since become sort of famous within the motoring sphere. They had a yellow Monaro with a model wearing a specially designed by a famous Toorak fashion designer white cat suit, and they shot it against a dark background. It was very spectacular.
This is the really interesting thing, because here we have Holden 1968 coming out with their first V8 muscle car, but so much of the marketing was pitched towards women.
Yeah, that's one of the remarkable things about it. Things were changing so quickly, I would think at the time, that they probably weren't sure exactly what their market was. They clearly marketed the car at males and females. Males, obviously, they pushed the sort of muscular sort of aspect of their car. And I mean, let's face it, it is a fairly muscular sort of car in style and substance. But yeah, they were hoping to sell them to women. They were running advertisements in the Australian Women's Weekly. They were pushing the car as, I think the advertisement line was, you can enjoy taking your kids to school in your Monaro. And yeah, so they were trying for the female market as much as the male market. I think they probably failed fairly dismally with the female market. Having said that, there were quite a lot of women that drove them and still do today.
It's a very stylish thing, and of course now has the added flavour of retro chic, the Holden Monaro. Steve, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Steve Normoyle, he's a contributing editor, Australian Muscle Car Magazine. Three pies down, one pie to go. Who will the winner be? Amanda Smith and Michael McKenzie are about to tell us. We're tasting pies. Pie number four, you two.
Right.
Well, already, on appearance, it's got something the others haven't.
There's a little fleckled, speckly bits on the top.
Yeah.
And there's classy,
it's rather
it?
Nice.
A lot of content inside.
Okay, here we go. Let's have a go pastry.
Ooh.
Oh, it's peppery.
Very peppery.
Ooh. There are flavours that I haven't...
That's interesting.
I feel like come across in a pie before.
Are those flavours authorised?
I feel like something wild's been shot and put inside a pastry case.
Oh, it's got an aftertaste too.
Mm. A lingering afterburn, as they say.
Mm. That's impressive.
I don't mind that one at all, actually.
Yeah,
I like that. That has a real sharpness about the pastry too has a nice
bite to it. Nice, unusual, different.
Yeah.
We haven't sourced any of them.
No.
But I think that's because we're purists.
Yep.
Normally I think we would have most of these with sauce.
Drowned in it.
Yes.
But for the sake of this exercise...
We're protecting our sauces.
We're just tasting the pies pure.
And a usually reliable sauce might be applied or non. All right, tasting notes on that last.
Okay.
It's interesting, you know, because in terms of gravy,
yep,
it's not much there, but I'm kind of glad about that. In the ones I like the most.
You often, I think, and the temperature here is interesting because these are at a real tasting room, mildness in terms of temperature. I mean, you might find at your football
that
your pie is going to be, well, that's what I was getting to.
That's kind of match ready, I reckon, ready temperature. It's also been microwaved in the way you would expect it to match.
It's very scoffable, eminently scoffable.
Oh, that's a nice scoring idea. Scoffable.
All right. We've now marked our four pies.
Mm. We need to add up.
We need to judge. And in a moment, we'll be back with the big reveal. All right, the judging panel, Michael McKenzie, Amanda Smith and Jonathan Green, have sat down with four pies and have tested each on overall appearance, pastry, meat, gravy and structural integrity, each category receiving a mark out of five. I can reveal that the winning pie... on a score, cumulatively, of 54, is pie D, the Bowcastle pie.
Right. Now, can I just interject and say that was not my favourite? That must have been...
We have a dissenting opinion.
Yes, your favourites, not mine. Mine was pie B.
Pie B, Philippus.
Pie B came third, pie A came second, and pie C, the 4 and 20.
I overlooked the fact that the winning pie, which I gave top score, actually had a hare in it.
Don't say that, sir. Everyone will want one.
I pushed that to one side.
Yes.
And still enjoyed it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That would have been a deal breaker for me.
What did we learn?
Well, it might have been my hair.
That's unlikely. What did we learn about the humble pie, you two?
Well, I think we've learnt that it's better if it's a bit tizzed up for us here at RN.
We like a tizzed up pie.
Yeah, we're all about a bourgeois case and we like a nice meaty filling. And if it's got vegetables in it as well, then we feel like we've got a whole food system.
Yes, balanced meal with a bit of veg in as well.
Well, thanks for bringing a bit of science into this endeavour. Much appreciated. Michael McKenzie and Amanda Smith, we've been tasting pies.
Counting the pies.
You've been listening to the last half hour this week dealing with football, meat pies, kangaroos and Holden cars, and you heard from Steve Normoyle, contributing editor to Australian Muscle Car magazine, Sid Sherin, fourth generation football maker, Pam Whiteley, coordinator of Wildlife Health Victoria, and RN's own Amanda Smith and Michael McKenzie, pie tasters by appointment. Producers Amira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla, technical production by Ari Gross. I'm Jonathan Green.
They go together. underneath the southern stars, football and meat pies, kangaroos and holden cars.